Hello, and welcome to another edition of Fly Fishing Tales, with me, John Howard. This time we're meeting with a world-renowned fishing writer, and one of the most influential. For 27 years he was the fishing correspondent of the Times newspaper, but it was his books that radically altered the approach of serious fly fishers worldwide. He is Brian Clark. His first book, The Pursuit of Stillwater Trout, described Brian's own research into trout behaviour. His second, The Trout and the Fly, written with another fly fishing great, John Goddard, further developed the scientific approach, having an international impact. The New York Times, without a hint of hyperbole, said, "If you're a fisherman, this book is probably going to change your life." My conversation with Brian took place back in 1999, as Brian fished and walked along a classic chalk stream in Hampshire, in southern England, as part of the original Fly Fishing Tales audio cassette series. What I published then was a 10-minute extract from a much longer recording. Going back to the original, I realised just what verbal gems and sparkling metaphors I'd left on the cutting room floor. Now, with podcasting, Brian's captivating voice and poetic turn of phrase have free rein to dabble on the surface of a fascinating fishing life.
I'm a very keen fly fisherman. I've been a fly fisherman for most of my remembered life.
Tell me a little bit about the river that we're standing by today and a little bit of its history and your thoughts on it.
Well, the river's the Meon, and we're in Hampshire, 6 or 7 miles from the sea. And the Meon is a pristine chalk stream. It's a chalk stream in miniature. When you fish this river, it's like fishing in Lilliput. Everything is to scale. The water itself is very small and narrow and shallow, clear as gin in a glass. And the trout are miniature too. If you catch a pound trout here, you've caught something to write home and tell your angling enemies about, so that they can become suitably jealous. It's a beautiful, beautiful little stream. It's quite a famous little stream in its way. Lots of famous anglers in the past fished it. Arthur Ransom, for example, was a regular down here. He used to come down here to write, and he fished this often in the 1930s, 1940s and early 50s. And folks like Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, who was a very keen fly fisher, he came down. Now, it's threatened like all small streams by abstraction. It's abstracted higher up. It's threatened by diffuse pollution from farmland and that kind of thing. And so, while it's full of swaying ranunculus and water celery and all of that kind of thing, if you look closely here and there, you can see small algal deposits, which are a sign of pollution. So it's a perfect little stream. It's just about as good as they get in modern-day Britain. But even now and here, you can see the threats that there are to it and to all rivers.
Bit of a windy day today, but what's the technique for fishing this river? How do you go about it?
Well, the first thing I do is to hurl myself on my knees and pray, because we have a very strong wind, as you say, and it's probably being picked up on the tape. It is not heavily stocked. It is a wild fish river. There is a sprinkling of stock fish, but they are very few and far between. The beat we're on today is a beat that is just about the most difficult chalk stream beat I know on any river. The stream itself is full of twists and turns and shallows and fast glides, so there's a tremendous drag problem. Getting near the water is one thing because of the overgrowth and shrubbery and that kind of thing. Getting a clear cast, rather, is another. Getting the fly on the water without drag is almost impossible. It's drag that is the major enemy here. Big D is the problem here. In terms of technique, we can fish the upstream nymph. It's the basic rules of chalk stream fishing. We can fish the upstream nymph and the upstream dry fly.
What are you looking for on this river? Just say a little bit about that.
I'm looking for places. This is a tiny stream full of bends, and fish will assume the lies in a stream that give it the things that it wants. And what a fish wants? It wants security, and it wants food, and it wants shade if it can get it. And so one looks for those places, and if you find deep water which gives it a sense of security, especially deep water if there's a tree over it, when it's on the outside of a bend where the current is funneled in, then you get all three together. So anything that brings those three together is a dead cert to hold a fish.
What got you into fishing?
Oh, what gets any of us? Well, it was childhood. My earliest fishing was on the rivers Skern and Tees in Darlington in the northeast. The Tees was, in its lower reaches then, so polluted that I guess lead shot wouldn't have sunk through it. In its upper reaches, above Darlington, where I lived, it was still reasonably clear, and it was a fine coarse fishing river, and it had some trout. My own first fish I remember spectacularly well was a gudgeon which I caught off the River Tees at Croft, and I remember this float curling. I was standing on a high stone wall there at a place called the Jetty. It was known locally as the Jetty, and it was a little stone promontory that stuck out into the river, and behind the river this promontory there was an eddy, and 12 feet down I lowered this little red-topped Bakelite float from a garden cane that had taped to it some bent safety pins as rod rings. I mean, that's really how basic it was. I was just a young lad. And I watched this little float go pirouetting and turning and waltzing around this eddy, and then suddenly it went plop, 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 and it was gone. And I winched in this tiny little gudgeon, and it came streaming up, and I wound it up, and I wound it up, and water and light and stardust were dripping from its tail, and it stopped right in front of me. And then it just began to turn, and it revolved almost as if for inspection, saying, look at me, look at me. And I did, and that was the moment I was completely hooked on fishing. So that's when it really began in the far northeast. Then, subsequently, my work as a journalist took me to London and Fleet Street, of course. And those pressures mounted, so every now and then I hoofed it off to the big reservoirs, and I fished the big Midlands reservoirs, then I fished in Ireland. And subsequently, of course, I've fished all over the world. But as part of my job, mercifully, the Sunday Times and the Times pick up the tab, so that's all right. And so I fished all over the world. But that's where the story began, in the far, grisly, old, dirty northeast, too long ago really to want to remember.
But something converted you to fly fishing. When did the light dawn there?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. The light dawned when... Once I was, this is when I was working with The Guardian in London, and I was going north to see my parents, and I'd read somewhere of Grafham opening. This was the mid-1960s, and I found myself driving up the A1, came to Huntington and saw Grafham signposted, so I turned off and went there, and I saw this vast sheet of water with boats on it and anglers fishing. And I saw chaps fishing with flies on the still water, and I saw some fish caught. And with all the pressures of working in Fleet Street and so forth, and I decided I've got to give this a go again, because in the early pursuit of my career, fishing had slipped, and girls and pubs and writing articles that nobody published, that kind of stuff, got in the way. So I decided I would take up angling again, and I decided that I would take up fly fishing. So that impetus came in the 1960s. I bought myself a rod and a line and a reel and swished about on the local village green. And so my fishing began about the time of the real explosion of interest in stillwater fly fishing in the 1960s. And it's gone on ever since.
It's quite a fast
carriage. It's very fast. It's very fast, and the breeze is just wicked. It's pushing this fly and line into the trees behind me. And as Dick Walker said, trees are always willing to step aside to grab your back cast anyway. So so I've got the wind and moving trees too. Let me just try that again. That's really a tight little neck in there.
As you'll probably know by now, the heart of these fly fishing tales is when my guests pick their most memorable catch. And when Brian described his to me, he gave a glimpse into what he finds most wonderful about the sport. And it also illustrates why he uses just two basic patterns for fly fishing.
If I had to pick one fish, it would be a trout that I caught on Draycott Reservoir in the Midlands, around the beginning of the 1970s. And it happened like this. By this time I was married, and I had all the pressures of a job. And and young children and a house and a garden that reproach me every time I look at it, and a wife and all of those kinds of things. And with all of those conflicting pressures, I still wanted to find this time for myself, which everyone needs. And so occasionally I went fishing. But because it was spasmodic and occasional, and I couldn't really pick my day or the weather, or often enough the place, I caught very little. I enjoyed going, but it was mostly anticipation. When I got there, it was quite often disappointment. I saw other people catching fish, but I failed. And I'm one of those folks, there are lots of us, unfortunately, who like to know what they're doing, when they're doing it, and why they're doing it. So I like cause and effect. I have a very high regard for cause and effect. And so I decided, if I wanted to make the most of my fishing, this spasmodic fishing, I had to do something which gave me a greater chance when these opportunities came. So I began to think about fish and fishing, and I decided that I had to give myself a leg up this greasy pole. So I booked in. There was a chap called Eric Birch. I guess Eric's long since dead, because this is a long time ago. But a chap called Eric Birch advertised, I think it was in Trout and Salmon, a fishing course. A weekend's fishing course for absolute beginners, which of course I was. I booked into this fishing course, and for the first day, it was a two-day course. The first day we were told about trout in general, and the kind of creatures they were, and this and that, and fishing, and tackle, and balance lines, and leaders, and rods, and all of that kind of stuff. In a second day, we were told about aquatic life and insects and fish. And I remember these slides going up, and Eric would say, that black blob, well, that's a snail, and this little chap over here, that's a shrimp, and that's a midge, and so forth. And so, for the first time, instead of just going to parties or wherever it was and buying these furry little jobs on hooks that looked like nothing on earth, here I was seeing real creatures, and I realised that most of the flies that I actually bought didn't look much like these at all. And then we had a break, and I cut lunch short and went out in the garden, and there was a tub in the garden. And this tub was full of water, and I must have been there a long time. And there in it were these little creatures I now know were tanapus, these little tiny midge-like jobs that hang by their tails from the surface of water butts. There were also some chironomids, and I could see the little pupae working their way up towards the surface and then sinking, and then working their way up towards the surface and sinking. And then I saw a fly hatch. And suddenly, all this talk and all of these slides and everything kind of clicked. And I saw what it was about, and I realized that this is what fish were eating. And so that was a seminal moment for me. Then that afternoon we went down Draycott Reservoir, and we came to this bay, and the wind was off the shore, and there were fish rising all over this bay. Now this must have been late April or early May, and there was this bay, so all the members of the course got around this bay. But I just felt that there was too much disturbance there, so being the slightly awkward chap I am, I got in my car and found a bay further downstream where the same conditions applied, but I was completely alone, so I could make my mistakes in private. But there were fish rising there, and Eric had told us that the rise forms were almost certainly two buzzers, and so he told us the fly we wanted was a black buzzer, so I put on a black buzzer, which is an imitation of the pupal form of the midge, the chironomids. And I cast out, and I drew on the line. And then I gave another draw, and another draw, and suddenly there was the humph in the water, humph. And the line twitched, and I struck. And there I caught this brown trout, about a pound and a half. So that was my first fish on an imitative fly. But that wasn't the important fish. The most important fish was the next fish. Then I saw, moving from my left to my right, a slow head and tailing roll. You know, that languorous, porpoising roll that you get from a fish feeding off stuff hanging from underneath the surface film. And I swished and swished around, and I cast out once, twice, three times, and didn't get it in front of the fish, in the direction the fish was heading. But finally, before it was out of sight and somewhere towards the Antipodes, I managed to get this fly over the water, and it landed just in front of it. And I just waited for a moment and then gave the leader the slowest draw. And there, it happened in slow motion. I can almost see the water peeling off this fish's back. Its back came up, and it rose, this porpoising rose, and then it went down, and the whole of the line waited and drew straight, and then just lifted, and I lifted it at this fish, and I hooked it, and this fish jumped and fought, and so, and that was the most electric moment, because that brought together everything. It brought together an end to my frustration. It brought a sense of purpose, because I knew what the fish were now feeding on. I knew what these creatures looked like. I knew how they moved, had some sense of how they moved in the water. I imitated that when I cast out this buzzer on the fly, and the fish responded in the most appropriate manner. And that was the most seminal moment. So from that point on, that was really the beginning of my fly fishing life. And thereafter, I went home, and the first thing that I did was to get a little clear plastic box. And I went off with my daughter's little trawling fishing net, these one of these little bamboo canes with a little white net underneath it. And I went to a local pond and I raked around in the weeds and I got some of the creatures out that the net caught. And I plopped these in some water that I took out of that pond into this box. And then I put in some weed and a few stones and some detritus out of the bottom. And I took it back to my study. And so for a year or more, I did nothing but study these creatures, try to tie imitations, and fish these imitations in a way in which I saw the natural move in my aquarium. And in that one season, my catch rate increased by something like 600%. It just rocketed. And that clearly was the key. That's not to say I blanked. That's not to say that I was never frustrated. That's not to say that I didn't ever fish a lure again or anything of that kind. It was just that one fish clicking and drawing everything together just dropped everything into its place. And for me, it gave me... So I then not only had the aesthetic satisfactions of fishing, I not only had the joys of being out in the water, I also had this wonderful sense of purpose and so forth. And so I remember that fish very fondly. It was my third fish that I recall clearly on a fly. It was my second fish on an imitative fly, and I hooked the fish and the fish hooked me. Well, they'll be feeding on anything that comes. They are not looking to flies and saying that's the wrong colour, that's the wrong size, it doesn't have the right number of legs. If it looks like food, they'll take it. They're opportunists. The fish in this river are small. They're not fussy. They will take whatever fly or nymph comes to them. That doesn't alarm them. And in fact, I only fish with two dry flies for the whole of my fishing. I fish with a little black fly and a little brown fly. And if they don't take one, they'll take the other. And if they don't take that, well, I don't offer them anything else because I don't believe in spoiling them.
Ah, well, I'm spoiling them then. The little black fly that Brian uses is a black buzzer. I can sometimes make one of those work, but if nothing's interested after 20 minutes, I'll usually try something else. Brian was working as a journalist, but his fascination with fishing lured him into some very experimental areas, which meant he began writing books too. So how did that happen?
I was reading Trout and Salmon in those days, so this is the early 1970s. And there really wasn't much in this. It was all seemed to be written by experts handing down tablets. There was nothing that really touched me as a beginner. And I just felt there had to be zillions of people like me, absolutely beginners, desperately wanting to succeed, desperate to get this day out, somewhat disappointed when they blanked and not knowing what to do about it. So I wrote to the editor, a wonderful man called Jack Thorndike, and I said, I've been doing this over the last year or so, and my catch rate has gone up by 600%. And it just seems to me that following this logical progression, it's been so helpful to me, it might be that it would be helpful to your readers. Why don't I do some articles for you? And there was a six-week silence. I remember this terribly well. And one morning the telephone rang, and it's Jack's broad Lower Midlands voice coming in, and he's saying, this is Jack Thorndike here. I've waited so long and I'm ringing you because I didn't know how to reply to your letter. He'd found it interesting and so, but didn't know how to respond. Anyway, we talked and we ended up that I would do a series, I think it was six articles. And these attracted a certain amount of attention from the readers, and by article four, Jack had asked me if I'd just go on writing, so I did. And I think it was Dick Walker and myself, we ended up having an article apiece in pretty well every issue of Trout and Salmon from that point on until the late 1970s when I kind of decided I'd said most of what I wanted to say and no point repeating it. So I stopped. And it was during that time, after about a year of these articles in Trout and Salmon, a publisher approached me and asked if I'd write a book, and I replied, no, I just imagine all these yawning white pages waiting to be filled, thousands of white pages, I just couldn't possibly do that. And then a well-known fly fisherman of the time, now sadly dead, Conrad Vos Bark, invited me to lunch at the Fly Fishers Club, and I went with him, and sneakily he'd inserted as his other guest this chap from the publisher who'd asked me to write a book. So anyway, over lunch they persuaded me to write the book. So I wrote this book called The Pursuit of Stillwater Trout, and it's done enormously well. It's done, I don't know how many it's done, the best part of 40,000 in hardback. And over a long period of time, of course. And that was quite influential, and this idea I'm not saying I invented it, but the book seems to have done something to popularise it, of fishing with imitative patterns, slowly on long readers, and very careful fishing. Brought some of the intimacy of river fishing to the vastness of lakes, where you could apply these intimate techniques, instead of sort of casting something out and pulling it back, and when it stops, you've got one kind of thing. So that was the first book. The second book was a book called The Trout and the Fly, and by this time my work had moved me to Hampshire, where we're sitting now. And of course it's chalk stream country, and in the course of producing The Pursuit of Stillwater Trout, I'd borrowed some flies from the great John Goddard, who's now one of my old, indeed I was fishing with him yesterday, one of my oldest and dearest friends. And John, who was then a major fisherman on the chalk streams, introduced me to chalk stream fishing. And John and I became quite fascinated. John had already written a number of books on entomology. I'd produced The Pursuit of Stillwater Trout. And we hatched this plot over a meal one evening of working on a book together. And we decided to do as much of it as we could from the trout's point of view, so that we could look up from the trout's point of view and see the surface, and we could see the underside of the surface reflected in the mirror. We could see out through the window that the trout sees through. We could see how flies appeared from deep down and close to the surface when viewed from beneath, as they were drifting across the mirror and the window of the trout. We put cameras into the riverbed and so forth, and as a consequence of what we saw and the behaviour of the fly when it is subject to the forces of reflection and refraction when viewed from below, we designed a series of flies. Not commercially practical flies, but flies that had a different appearance and gave the trout what the natural fly appeared to give it when viewed from below the surface. And we designed these flies. And so we produced this book called The Trout and the Fly, which again has been phenomenally successful. It has been reprinted all over the world. It did two hardback and softback in the States. The New York Times gave it a 2.5 column review. I've got it in my study from Jimmy Carter, written on the White House notepaper when he was president, saying how much he'd enjoyed it and so forth. The casting's very demanding here because of all the... Oh, there's the kingfisher. Did you see that? Kingfisher just shot by. This is one of the wonders of a stream like this. It's just full of life. And it also gets some... There used to be a famous sea trout stream. And I've actually had a couple of sea trout off it, but there's now some kind of barrier lower down that stops them getting up, unfortunately. Just another of the many things that we're doing to our rivers. This is a tricky little stream. It's one of the joys of it.
In the past, when asked, Brian's listed among his non-angling interests sitting still in the countryside, watching and listening. So it's not surprising he has a keen interest in the environment, and the next book he wrote was a novel but with a powerful message. In it, Brian described the desecration of our planet and the plundering of the countryside. Called The Stream, we tend to think that environmental concerns are recent, but here was Brian writing about pollution and what we were doing to the world in the 1990s.
No one could spend the time in the countryside that an angler does without being conscious of the impact of human life on the environment around him, and he sees it close up in terms of pollution of rivers and so forth. And I've seen major pollution incidents close up. And I decided a long time ago that I would like to write a book about pollution. And the more I thought about it, the more parallels I saw between the tiny world of the rivers that I fish and what was happening to them, and the tiny world that planet Earth is, spaceship Earth, a speck drifting around in space, a sealed environment, and human pressures on that too. So I saw a strong parallel between water and streams and the whole Earth. And so I decided to write a novel, which I've done, called The Stream, which is essentially a metaphor for the whole planet. And I describe a pristine, very beautiful stream, not unlike the one we're sitting beside today, slowly becoming polluted. And I tell the story from two points of view. One is the story of the human beings who live along its banks and who have to exist and have jobs and get from A to B, and who want fridges the way I do and you do, and cars the way I do and you do, and the resulting pollution that comes from that. And the way the story describes the way the everyday lives of these people, intending no harm, impinges on life in the river. And the story is told from two points of view. It's told from life out of the water and life lived alongside fish and insects and mayflies and shrimps living underwater. And as the human population burgeons and goes about its business, so the stream slowly dies. And it's really quite a poignant story. I'm delighted to say it's doing very well. It's won a couple of prizes and it's sold a lot, which keeps me happy. But more important, I think, is to get the messages across about what we're doing to planet Earth and the environment around us. Not in any condemnatory way, not to say we mustn't do this, because, you know, we're all part of the problem. We're not on planet X looking down and saying it isn't terrible down there. We're down there living it and creating it. But really, as a means, I wrote it to just point at people to say, look, this is what is happening. Look, think, look again.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic, though?
I'm pessimistic. I don't believe... I have a character in the book who says that... something to the effect that... to ask human beings to change their behaviour is tantamount to ask them to change their nature. And that they cannot do. And that, I think, sums it up. I think that human greed, human necessity, population explosion, the wish of all those human beings to have their lives fulfilled by material needs, and even in some cases just the need to clean water and food. I think all of those inexorable pressures are going over time to place demands on the Earth they cannot sustain. And that I think that as the whole of nature has shown us in the past, something will occur, some environmental threshold will be stepped over that will change things utterly. And then I think the human race is likely to come close to extinction itself. Or other life will continue, but human life will either be much retrenched and driven back, or will be wiped out, and planet Earth will then go on smiling happily in the voids of space, unsullied.
If you go back to your metaphor, the stream... the stream we're by now, the Meon, has been like this for hundreds of years. You might even say, in some circumstances, it's cleaner now than it has been for a long time. And you are fishing it still, and there are fish there, wild fish there, to be caught still.
Well, I take the principle of what you're saying, but I mean, the premise is that this is in some way typical. But of course it's not. We're sitting beside a tiny chalk stream that is hugely, ferociously preserved. As all of these places are, as all of the chalk streams are. But not every river is hugely ferociously preserved. Who's preserving the seas? Is the United States preserving the seas? Is China going to preserve the atmosphere as it pursues economic growth for its huge teeming millions? Is India? I mean, that's the scenario that we're looking at. And I'm simply being realistic. You asked me if I was a pessimist. I am only in the most literal sense. You know, we can go on for a while. I don't know how long we'll go on. But I dedicate the stream to my grandchildren for very good reason. And it is because it's their future that we are taking in our hands now. And whatever we do today narrows their options tomorrow. That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, 20 years on, and we haven't finished off the planet yet, Brian, but we are still struggling with many of the same concerns as we had in the 1990s. That's it for this edition of Fly Fishing Tales. I look forward to being with you the next time.